you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask what's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and to all our listeners joining us across the region and, of course, around the world. Welcome to Eagle FM. I am your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and you are tuned in to On the Radar News Analysis this Thursday, the 14th of May, 2026. Now, as Namibia observes Ascension Day, we welcome you on this public holiday edition of the program, your trusted platform for informed discussion, critical thinking, and deeper insights into the stories shaping the nation today. Now, even on a day of reflection and observance, the country's economic, political, and social landscape continues to evolve. And this afternoon, we once again focus on the developments influencing governance, business, innovation, investment, and the everyday realities facing communities across Namibia. Now, today's program reflects on some of the major conversations that dominated the national agenda this week. We'll also continue examining the importance of partnerships between government, the private sector, and the international stakeholders as Namibia positions itself within a rapidly changing global economy. And as always, we go beyond the headlines to ask the important questions on what do these developments mean for ordinary Namibians? How prepared is the country for the opportunities and the challenges ahead? And how can policy, innovation, and investment contribute to long-term growth and inclusion? Now, right here on the Radar News Analysis, we believe informed citizens build stronger societies. That is why we do more than simply report events. We provide context, encourage dialogue, and create space for meaningful national engagement. Now, every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we bring you informed analysis, expert perspectives, archived sound, and your voice in the conversation, because in a world of overflowing with information, understanding remains essential and critical. Now, you can tune in via Eagle FM frequencies, stream us via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app and stay connected through our digital platforms on Facebook, on Instagram, on LinkedIn, or our WhatsApp channel for updates, discussions, and exclusive content. So wherever you are this afternoon, at home, with family, traveling, relaxing on this public holiday, at work, or perhaps listening from the diaspora, thank you for choosing Eagle FM. Now do stay informed, stay engaged, and stay part of the conversation, because on the radar, Namibia doesn't just listen, but comes to think and interrogate issues. Let's get right into today's conversations. Emma Theophilus, Minister of ICT, says Namibia cannot afford to wait for perfect conditions before embracing technology and unlocking opportunities within the country's digital economy. She was speaking at the launch of the Women in Tech and 2026 National Talent Cultivation Project during the Hawaii ICT Congress Gala Dinner in Windhoek. The Minister of Information and Communication Technology said government remains committed to creating and in an enabling environment for innovation, for digital inclusion and skills development. Theophilus acknowledged that resistance to technology adaptation still exists in some communities, particularly regarding digital transformation or digital infrastructure and online services. But she stressed that Namibia must continue advancing while communities adapt to a challenging technological landscape. She also called for stronger collaboration between government and the private sector to accelerate Namibia's digital transformation agenda and equip more young people, especially women, with ICT skills needed for the future economy. Now, during the event, the minister presented awards through Hawaii in recognition of contributions towards digital information and ICT development. The event was attended by Sem Nyoma, that Honorable Sem Safishna Nyoma, that is Governor of Commerce Region, representatives from the Hawaii Sub-Saharan Africa, the Embassy of China in Namibia, and industry stakeholders. Now, for some might be wondering why this is important, why digital skills and technology initiatives matter for Namibia's future. Now, remarks by the minister, that is Minister Emma Teofilix, during the Hawaii ICT Congress Gala Dinner, have once again placed attention on the growing importance of technology, innovation, and digital inclusion in Namibia's development agenda. Now, speaking at the launch, she stressed that Namibia cannot afford to delay embracing technology while waiting for ideal conditions. Beyond the speeches and ceremonial aspects of such events, initiatives focused on ICT development and digital skills training are increasingly viewed as essential to Namibia's long-term economic growth and competitiveness. As economies around the world become more digital, countries that invest in technology, in innovation and skills development are better positioned to attract investment, to create employment, and to improve public services. That is, for countries that invest in technology, in innovation and skills development, because that is the way the world is going now. Now, for Namibia, strengthening digital infrastructure and expanding access to ICT opportunities could help unlock growth in sectors ranging from education and healthcare to finance to mining to agriculture and to entrepreneurship. Because in every one of these areas, technological infrastructures are well poised and able to accelerate this area, so these sectors further. Now, one of the key aspects highlighted through programs such as Women in Tech is in inclusion. Across many countries, women remain underrepresented in science, in technology, and in engineering fields. Encouraging more women and young girls to enter the ICT sector not only promotes gender equality, but also helps to expand the country's future talent pool in industries expected to drive economic transformation. Another initiative also reflects growing recognition that digital literacy is no longer limited to the technology sector alone. Basic ICT skills are increasingly becoming necessary across almost every industry, and that includes business, government administration, education, and also, and most definitely, the communication sector. Technology initiatives also play an important role in addressing youth unemployment. Training programs linked to software development, networking, cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and digital entrepreneurship can create pathways for young people to access both local and international opportunities within the digital economy. Now, at the same time, discussions around digital transformation often raise concerns about unequal access to technology, particularly in rural communities where internet connectivity and digital infrastructure may still be limited. Now, this is why collaboration between government and the private sector remains critical and crucial in expanding affordable internet access and ensuring that digital opportunities are accessible to a broader population. Now, the involvement of companies such as Huawei also highlights the growing role of international partnerships in supporting Namibia's ICT development through infrastructure investment, skills training, and technology transfer. Now, as Namibia continues positioning itself within the rapidly evolving global economy, initiatives focused on innovation, on digital inclusion, and talent development are increasingly being viewed as more than corporate events, but as part of the broader foundation needed to prepare the country for the future world of work and economic transformation. Nonetheless, let's pause right here now. But the studio line is very much open for you to come through and engage us on this news. 083-288-401 is the number in studio. Let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the R.
Ikuranenge no wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni mondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwala. Onongeshefa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okupitira oipindi konu konda doi inawa. Nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi tayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijabo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. The official handover ceremony of delegated functions to regional councils happened in Ochoa-Rongo as government moves forward with efforts to strengthen decentralization and improve service delivery at regional level. The ceremony brought together government officials, regional leadership and stakeholders to formalize the transfer of selected responsibilities and functions from central government to regional councils. Now, the delegation of functions forms a part of Namibia's broader decentralization process that is aimed at improving administrative efficiency, accelerating decision-making, and allowing regional authorities to respond more directly to the needs of the local communities. Now, the initiative is also expected to strengthen governance structures at regional level by giving councils greater responsibility in managing development priorities and delivering public services. Now, the event in the Ochoa-Dupra region highlights government's continued focus on bringing services closer to communities while promoting accountability and regional development. Now, let's take a listen to Mr. Gerald Roman Ferris, and he is an ED in the Ministry of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts, and Culture.
Senior officials and staff members from the Ministry of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts, and Culture, and the Ministry of Urban and Regional Development, members of the media, ladies and gentlemen. It is my distinct honor and privilege to address you today on this important occasion marking the official handing over of decentralized youth and sport functions to all 14 regional councils of our country, Namibia. This event represents more than an administrative process. It signifies government's continued commitment to deepening decentralization, strengthening local governance, and ensuring that services reach the people where they live. Today, we are taking another decisive step towards empowering our regions to respond more effectively to the needs and aspirations of our youth and sporting communities. Ladies and gentlemen, the decentralization process is guided by the Decentralization Enabling Act 2000, Act number 33 of 2000, which provides the legal framework for the transfer of functions from central government to regional councils and local authorities. In line with this framework, Cabinet Decision number 10/28/06/2022/002 approved the delegation of identified functions under the Department of Youth, Sports and National Service to all 14 regional councils. This decision reflects government's recognition that development is most effective when planning and implementation occur closer to the communities being served. It also acknowledges the important role regional councils play in understanding local realities, identifying regional priorities, and delivering responsive services. Today's handover, therefore, marks a major milestone in the transformation of youth and sport administration in Namibia. Distinguished guests, youth remain at the center of our national development goals. They are not merely beneficiaries of development, but active drivers of social and economic progress. Equally, sport continues to serve as a powerful instrument for national unity, health promotion, social inclusion, talent development, and economic opportunity. While the ministry continues to face challenges, including a skewed organizational structure, budgetary constraints, an aging fleet, and other operational limitations, we have nonetheless made significant strides despite these difficulties. We therefore call upon your continued support and partnership as we work together to overcome these challenges for the betterment of our youth, athletes, and communities at large. By decentralizing these functions, government seeks to ensure that opportunities for youth empowerment and sport development are expanded to all corners of the country, including rural and underserved communities. The key functions being handed over today include youth empowerment and development, sport promotion and support, and planning and development. These functions will enable regional councils to play a more direct role in coordinating youth programs, supporting community sport initiatives, identifying local talent, facilitating stakeholder engagement, and promoting inclusive regional development. Ladies and gentlemen, as these responsibilities are handed over, it is important to emphasize that decentralization is not merely about transferring functions. It is about building partnerships, strengthening institutional capacity, enhancing accountability, and improving service delivery outcomes for our people. The success of this process will depend on effective collaboration between the ministry and regional councils. We must continue working together to ensure that the transition is smooth, transparent, and sustainable. I therefore wish to encourage all regional councils to embrace these responsibilities with commitment and dedication. Let us ensure that the delegated functions are implemented efficiently, equitably, and in accordance with the established legal and policy frameworks. To our officials and technical teams who have worked tirelessly to make this process possible, I extend sincere appreciation for your professionalism and dedication. Your efforts have laid the foundation for a more responsive and community-driven youth and sports sector. I also wish to acknowledge our regional leadership, the facilitating ministry responsible for decentralization in Namibia, Ministry of Urban and Rural Development, and stakeholders for their continued cooperation and support throughout this process. Distinguished guests, this handover is ultimately about improving lives of our young people and strengthening opportunities for sport participation and development across Namibia. It is about ensuring that every young person, regardless of where they live, have access to programs and opportunities that enable them to realize their full potential. As government, we remain committed to empowering youth, promoting active citizenship, and creating environments where talent can thrive. Let us therefore move forward together with a shared vision of inclusion, development, effective local governance, and strengthened regional service delivery. I thank you.
Also speaking at the event is Minister James Sankwasa.
I'm profoundly happy to stand before you this morning on this occasion of marking a handover of the functions of the Ministry of Education, Youth and Sports to the various regional councils. First and foremost, allow me to sincerely thank my colleague, Dr. Steenkamp, for inviting me to come and witness this important milestone in our decentralization program. This occasion should not be seen as an administrative exercise in the name of decentralization, but a reaffirmation and a demonstration of government's commitment to decentralizing functions of central government to the grassroots. I'm informed that extensive consultation has happened at the administrative level and has, as a result, resulted in today's occasion. As a ministry entrusted with coordinating and facilitating decentralization implementation in Namibia, I strongly believe that decentralization is not merely transferring functions between levels of government. It is, and I must rather be, about empowering subnational governments to be ready to function like the central government. But the question is, decentralization in Namibia started way back at independence, because our constitution talks about the establishment of regional councils and local authorities. That was the beginning of decentralization, 1990. And then this was realized through the promulgation of various parliamentary acts, one of them being the Regional Council Act, 1992, the Local Authority Act in 1992. Then in 2000, the Decentralization Act. Now, if you look between 2000 and now, one asks, why is decentralization failing to take shape in this country? From independence to now, there are various factors that could be at play, not necessarily that are the only ones. Successful decentralization requires a combination of legal frameworks, which we have in place. As I said, we have the Constitution, we have the Regional Council Act, we have the Decentralization Act. That talks about purely what happens at the regional local authority level. And the only legal framework also that we have, which is cutting across, is the State Finance Act. Because whether you're at the regional council level, where the ministry level, you use the same State Finance Act, which controls the finances of the state. Then we have the Procurement Act, which is cutting across all levels. Does not need the adjustments. But when it comes to the Public Service Act that is responsible for human capital management at regional councils, there lies a challenge. Because the regional council is required to have two heads when it comes to human capital management. One, the Public Service Act 13 of 1995, when it comes to managing staff members that are decentralized from national level, regional councils. That act becomes operative. Then we have the Public Service Act 2 of 1980, which is applicable to staff members of the regional council. So they requires skills management, proper understanding of the legal framework that must govern the administrative part of the decentralized functions. Then we have the issue of the challenge of the governors. Governors are appointed in terms of the constitution and in terms of the representative authority proclamation. Governors are not in terms of the Regional Council Act. They are in terms of the constitution and the representative proclamation. While the regional council is in terms of the Regional Council Act, what is the difference between these two entities? The governor is in charge of the region, not the council. The governor's office cannot be sued in a court of law because it's not a juristic person. The regional council is a juristic person that can stand before a court of law and be sued in his own right. But then, what does the representative proclamation say? It requires intergovernmental approach. Because the constitution and this act also says there has to be a symbiotic relationship between the governor's office and the regional council. Otherwise, the whole region becomes dysfunctional. So therefore, the governor is the head of the region. And within that region, there is a regional council, there is a local authority councils. Understand that umbrella properly. The governor is the umbrella in the region. Underneath this umbrella, there is a regional council. There are local authority councils. There are traditional authorities. So there is no way that the regional council will be above that of the governor. Because the governor is the umbrella. What we have as a challenge in this country is understanding the legal framework that must govern our actions. We are prone to saying according to the law. When you are asking according to the law, when you ask which law, no, according to the law. Because it's normally said, if you want to hide something from a black person, put it in the book. Because blacks don't read. we don't read in this country, to understand our sphere of operation. The first challenge. The existing legislative and institutional frameworks are already in place. The challenge is in the implementation. The implementers are required to have proper skills in leadership, proper skills and knowledge in management and administration. And if these are absent, the council management becomes a casualty. So therefore, we need to assess whether regional councils are ready to receive the decentralized function, and whether the staff members also being decentralized are ready to be received by the regional council. That relationship should be managed properly. Because in some cases, this is not the first ministry that is decentralized. In some cases, we have seen decentralized functions or directorates in the regional council wanting to have nothing to do with the regional council. They want to still want to remain attached to the central government level. They claim to say their authority, whatever they want, they'll get it from the central ministry. They reject anything coming from the regional council level. They forget they have been decentralized already there. What is remaining there is their salary. But the supervision, the operation is now within the regional council. Let's understand that correctly. The moment you are a staff member employed in a ministry and you decentralize the regional council, your operation, your supervisor is now the regional council, not the ministry. And the sooner we accept that fact, the better for everybody. Procurement at the regional level, as I said, should be done in terms of the Procurement Act. Now, you are not going to set a separate procurement unit for education, for health, for whatever. There is a procurement committee at the regional council level. That's where everybody must fit in. Everybody has to fit in. And be that as it is, the minister, the governor, the chairperson of regional councils have very little to do with procurement function, because you don't sit in that committee. But however, we have a responsibility as politicians, because when there is a mismanagement of the procurement and that thing must now end in court, who gets sued? It's not you as a staff member to stand in the court. The respondents become the minister, the regional council, or the chairperson of the regional council. Not you as a staff member or a member of the management committee. You don't get sued. So therefore, because of that representative part, we as political leaders, be it national level, regional level, have got to undertake proper monitoring. Proper monitoring through reports that you have to submit of what have you done with the procurement over the last quarter or last month. You have to report, because you have to monitor. And the monitoring is very, very important, because even the creation of this world, God has been monitoring. He was evaluating and monitoring. If you read it properly, the first day God did this. Before he continued doing the second day, he looked at what he did the previous day. And he said, so it was good. Then he moved on. The third day, he checked the second day. And he said it was good. Until he was satisfied that everything is good. Now I have done it. So we as political heads have a responsibility to monitor what administration is doing. And how do we do it? Most of the time, staff members are saying politicians are interfering in administration. We don't interfere in administration. No chancellor, no governor, no minister must interfere in administration. But we have a role to intervene. Get the difference? We have to intervene. Interference comes when a minister, a politician comes and say, I want this tender to go to this company. That's interference. Because now you are instructing which company must get the tender. That is not correct for a politician. But where we sit as politicians and have got wind to say the people that are involved in procurement has already allocated this tender before it was even advertised, we have a right and a full responsibility to intervene and stop the rot. We'll stop the rot. I hope I'm making myself very clear this morning. No interference, but there is intervention. Where things are not going right, the councillor must intervene. The governor must intervene. The minister must intervene to correct the situation. So therefore, we expect a proper symbiotic relationship of operation between the decentralized staff members and the regional councillors that receive them and the office of the regional governor. Because for us as ministers, with me and my counterpart, we are sitting in Vendo. We don't know what is happening there.
Save more with massive May deals at WB. Like 2 kg Marathon Light Brown Sugar for $36.99. 500 gram Ellis Brown Creamer for just $34.99. 5 kg Top Score Super Maize for $62.99. And 1 kg Sunlight Hand Wash Powder for only $31.99. See more mid-month specials at furmanbrock.com. We care.
I don't know what is happening there. I have already mentioned some of these things, but allow me to say, on behalf of my ministry, Honorable Minister, I want to welcome wholeheartedly the functions of youth empowerment and development, sports promotion and support, and planning and development. And if you do sports properly, sports is part of employment. We create self-employment for our people. We have seen how we produce the Maslingi in this country, the Frank Fredericks. They didn't leave that to come and look for employment in the regional council because they became self-employed. So what we need to do as leadership is to create a conducive environment that produces and recognizes the talent that we have in the regions, which we have in this country. We have Benson, who became a world-class athlete. And that environment should be created by us. Let us move away from being too bureaucratic. Because bureaucracy is the umbrella that failures use not to execute duties. So today, colleagues, we are here to witness yet another milestone, as I said, to welcome the function that must be done at the grassroots, because sports is in primary schools, sports is already in the villages. You don't need to have a certificate, your graduate certificate, to be recognized as international sportsman or sportswoman. You just need to recognize the talent, and let's learn how to scout those talents. In conclusion, I would like to once more renew my ministry's and government's continued commitment and support to subnational level governments, as well as the full implementation of the decentralization policy. But this one can only be realized if the people at the regional level can come up with commitment to performance, can demonstrate the knowledge in management. The skills in the operation of regional councils, then decentralization will be realized. I believe that if we don't engage ourselves into asking the question, why am I here? The counselor must ask himself or herself, why am I a counselor? Among the counselors, the chairperson of the council must ask, why am I a chairperson? And what is expected of me as a chairperson? As a CRO, why are you a CRO? As a director, why are you a director and what are you directing? Where are you directing the people to? Because you can't be a director if you're not directing. Have a proper administrative compass that tells you to say, this is a strategic plan of the regional council. How does it combine with the strategic plan of the various directorates that have been decentralized so that together the region achieves more? I thank you all.
And now let's hear from the Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture herself. That is Ms. Sanet Steenkamp.
Most delighted. We had a discussion with the chairperson of the Regional Council of Otjesintyupa, Honorable Nelumbu, this morning. And we talked about the development in the town and what this hotel also represents. But it was more than that. It was also the vibe and the energy that I found when I walked in here, knowing that the past 2 days have been significant in terms of the induction, in terms of presentations, specific functions, specific roles, clarification, and that there will still be further training, the professional development that Mr. Imbua is making reference to. Since the adoption of the decentralization policy in 1997, and again we've heard about the policy of 2000, the education sector has consistently supported the decentralization agenda. Already in 1999, the ministry presented its first draft of the decentralization action plan, although only much later in the 2000s did we transfer key functions including primary and secondary education, community libraries, adult education, arts and culture programs, and school hostels to regional councils. Today we are honored to mark yet another important milestone in this journey by formally handing over the youth and sports functions to the regional councils. These sectors are among the 7 key priorities identified in the SWAPO Party manifesto and are equally aligned with the objectives of the 6th National Development Plan. There are 7 key priorities, 4 of them resorts within our ministry. Second on the agenda is sports development, followed by youth empowerment. And then we have the commitment to quality education and also the creative industries. That's no small feat, ladies and gentlemen. And decentralization remains for all of us a cornerstone of our democratic governance. Embedded in Chapter 12 of the Namibian Constitution and with an overview and passionate commitment just delivered by Honorable Nsan Kwasa, I think we all are aware that it laid the foundation for democratic participation but also sustainable development. Article 1 affirms Namibia as a democratic and unitary state administered through the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. In this regard, the realization by our government that our historical inequalities inherited from colonial rule requires a phased approach to decentralization and eventually devolution. I think that is the elephant in the room that none of us want to mention at this point. Director of Proceedings, ladies and gentlemen, the staff members of our ministry and the unions have been consulted before engaging into signing the secondment letters. Today I'm pleased to announce that following the integration of the Department of Youth, Sports and National Service into the ministry in 2025, we continued with the necessary processes to prepare for the delegation of functions. I'm therefore further delighted to note that the youth and sport functions are officially and were officially gazetted on the 24th of May, 2024 already. 24th of May, 2024. Comprehensive consultations and induction sessions are on the functions to be delegated were indeed conducted with staff members and regional councils in August 2025. Prior to this, approval has been granted by the Office of the Prime Minister on the 19th of July 2024 for the secondment of staff to the regional councils. A total of 327 staff members will be seconded as part of this process. Honourable Minister and Honourable Governor, esteemed chairpersons, Director of Proceedings, ladies and gentlemen, following this handover, the Ministry's technical team, in collaboration with the Ministry of Urban and Rural Development, will continue to support individual regions in finalising the transition. We have made that commitment and we have to honour it. This will include addressing detailed operational matters relating to the delegated functions, including the sort of office accommodation, assets, human resources, and financial arrangements. This takes out the bureaucratic layers that slowed down delivery and they diluted the impact. And we are truly hopeful that, as it was said by the former speakers equally, that decision maker will now be in the hands of those who truly understand the context and the intricacies, the local needs, the talent, but also local terrain. Experience has shown that clear communication channels and well-defined procedures are essential for both the Ministry of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture and the regional councils. As we advance towards full devolution within the broader decentralization process, I call for continued close collaboration, mutual commitment and the strengthening of partnership among all our institutions. Honourable Sankwasa asked a very pertinent question. Actually, he asked two. He asked the first one, why are we not being successful as we should be with decentralisation? And secondly, why is it that we are in the positions where we are? I will unpack that also very briefly a little bit. The moment someone begins to derive personal superiority from this delegated mandate, they have inverted the entire purpose of public service. Our legal frameworks that has been quoted and which we are being guided on, all calls not just for the will and the ability, as the Honourable Minister said, but also for a clarification of roles and functions, and an understanding and an adherence to that clarity of roles, which will prevent any of us to abuse the role. When we all understand the difference between implementation and policy making, when we all understand the difference between leading and micromanagement, that is when clarity creates a system that will truly work. I think one thing as an accounting officer previously, working very closely with the team that sits on my left, Mr. Mboa would always say, we are all accountable, we are all gainfully employed. So that question that we must be asking as to why are we in the positions that we are, that is absolutely critical. In closing, allow me to extend my sincere appreciation to all the officials of the Regional Council, the Office of the Prime Minister, and most importantly also to the Minister, James Sankwasa. Honourable Minister, thank you very much for giving us your time, your expertise, providing leadership and authority where it's needed most. Wish to thank also all the officials from our ministry, MESAC. Thank you for your invaluable contributions in the planning, the implementation, and the oversight of the functions to be delegated. As regional chairperson.
And with that, we pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Titanium, the perfect fit between platinum and silver, complementing our existing benefit options. We always offer a comprehensive healthcare experience. NHP, the premier member-centric medical aid fund. Visit NHP today at nhp.com.na. NHP, we're about you.
Why pay more when you can pay less at USave stores? Enjoy nutritious and delicious meals for the whole family. 2 kilograms of real good frozen mixed chicken portions for only 99.99 Namibian dollars. 5 kilograms of Rice King, just 92.99 Namibian dollars. Save 7 Namibian dollars. 500 grams of U-brand 40% fat spread, just 14.99 Namibian dollars. 500 grams of Wright brand spaghetti, just 9.99 Namibian dollars. USave, where good food costs less.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe tike kovano hile koshuana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo IGL FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge fata fanona monika ko IGL FM onore tatumwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa mura hetatu natu bali o hetatu matatu oma felane IGL FM VI.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere, countrywide, to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Welcome back, and now for some traffic advisory regarding the IUM Winter Convocation happening in Ungwediva. The International University of Management, IUM, is proud to announce a historical milestone as it hosts its first ever Winter Convocation in Northern Namibia. The ceremony will take place on Friday, the 15th of May, 2026 at the Ungwediva Trade Fair Center and is expected to attract a large number of graduates, families and dignitaries. Members of the public are advised to expect increased traffic volumes in and around Ungwediva, particularly near the Trade Fair Center between 6 a.m. and 15 p.m. on the day of the event. If you will be attending, please take note, gates will open at 6 a.m. and will strictly close at 7 a.m. No entry will be permitted after 7 a.m. Guests are also informed that babies and toddlers will not be permitted inside the venue. Attendees are encouraged to plan their journey in advance, arrive early, and join IOM in celebrating this memorable occasion. The public is urged to exercise patience and caution to ensure the safety of all road users during this important occasion. IOM extends its heartfelt congratulations to all graduates and looks forward to celebrating this memorable event together and appreciates everyone's cooperation. Now, with that being said, let's get into news beyond the borders of Namibia. And as always, we start off regionally and move over to continental news. Let's start off within the borders of South Africa, as Action SA has opened a criminal case against President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Court found that Parliament acted inconsistently with the Constitution when it declined to adopt the Section 89 panel report and failed to refer the matter to an impeachment committee. Action SA has now opened a criminal case against President Cyril Ramaphosa.
I think the President has misled this country from day one in respect of Palapala. I don't think a word of truth has come out of his mouth in respect to this issue. And just 2 days ago, we received a lecture as a country about the rule of law from a person who keeps millions of rands in foreign currency stored in his furniture. I think the President has no credibility when it comes to the rule of law and this issue. I think as a country, we are battling with lawlessness and corruption, and we're never going to win that battle when our president himself is not going to subject himself to accountability. He has dodged accountability at every turn, and now the chickens have come home to roost in a parliament where he no longer has a majority that can protect him.
Beaumont says they will take a firm stance in the impeachment proceedings to demand answer and accountability.
Action SA is in opposition. We are leading the way in this matter. And to demonstrate consistency, we have been combating the issue of Palapala since 2021. It goes long before any particular election cycle that we can demonstrate how we've been consistent in this issue. And I'm very glad that I'm joined here by our Member of Parliament, Lerato Ngobeni, our Chief Whip. She is going to be serving on the Impeachment Committee for Action SA. And the South African people can accept the same flames to arise from Lerato's representation on that committee that they have believed to see to come from Action SA all the time. We are going to fly the flag high for accountability in a parliament where too many people have been silenced by their involvement in this GNU.
Meanwhile, party supporters had gathered outside the police station. They want accountability and transparency in the matter.
When you have a person in the position of the president breaking the law, it becomes very questionable. So it's very important to us, not only Action SA, but also the country, to see the law being upheld, to see a leader who is ethical in the position of the president taking responsibility for his actions. But what we have seen so far is a president who is not taking responsibility for his actions.
As we speak now, South Africa is a crime scene. So if our number one also is also one of those criminals, Baba Irang corruption in our country, he must take accountability. That's why we are here as SNC. We said something must be done about this.
Action SA says it will continue pursuing the matter through legal channels, although President Cyril Ramaphosa has indicated that he will take the Constitutional Court ruling under review. Rendani Ralipasa, SABC News, Vila Vila Police Station.
Meanwhile, during the Africa CEO Forum, FNB CEO in Zambia, Kampepe Chola speaks to SABC.
Marketed as Africa's premium private sector gathering, the Africa CEO Forum Annual Summit has returned to Kigali, Rwanda. It's a two-day forum bringing together key stakeholders for high-level discussions, debates and strategic engagements focused on the private sector's role in advancing the continent's growth and development. SABC News Acting International Editor Blaine Herman is live for us in Kigali and joins us with the very latest. A very good morning to you, at least on our side, Blaine. It's billed as Africa's biggest private sector gathering. If we had to be very granular at this point, what are the issues that the private sector wants or is deliberating on?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you mentioned it's high-level delegations or high-level talks, right, Mfundo? But I think the biggest thing is for action to come off this. We are live from the Kigali Convention Center. It is no doubt an impressive city. And I was just remarking earlier on with regards to the pristine streets of Kigali. It's really a powerful reflection of the spirit behind the Africa CEO Forum. And we heard from the president of Rwanda as well, saying that Africa needs to take advantage of its competitiveness on the world stage as well. What does that mean? Let's bring in the better mind, that is Kampumpe Chola, Executive Officer, Chief Executive Officer of FNB Zambia. Let me just read something for you very quickly. She's also the first woman to hold the position. She's previously served as the country director for Rand Merchant Bank, Botswana, head of corporate and investment banking at FNB Zambia, as well as earlier roles in major banks. That takes up half of our interview time, but it's no doubt impressive. You're the right person to speak to. Talk to us about the importance of having an event such as this, given the geopolitical tensions, given the, some would say, instability around the world.
Blaine, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here at the Africa CEO Forum. It is a great time to be an African. Yes, we can talk about the geopolitics and all the so-called instability around the world and the shifting landscape when it comes to aid, when it comes to support to some programs that Africa's had. But I think what's important here and what's important and the messages going out at the session is about the scale imperative for Africa. In fact, it's scale or fail and why Africa must embrace shared ownership. So these are key messages today because Africa is going to drive Africa's agenda. Yeah. And I think what you said is clear that we've known this for a while. We have conversations about this, but it's about the action. Right. It's about execution. Agreements will not create employment. They will not create value. Yeah. But transactions which come out of execution will.
What are some of the key sectors that people are talking about, investors are talking about, CEOs like yourself are talking about at this forum in order to drive this investment, drive growth?
I mean, the important conversation we're having is about how Africa must industrialize. Now, Africa cannot industrialize without power, without sustainable energy. So energy is a key sector that's being discussed here. Discussions around energy generation, but also importantly, energy transmission. How do we get this excess power in some of the East African countries, say Tanzania, into power-starved areas, mining areas of the DRC? That is critical. We've got to get energy. We've got to have sustainable energy. We've got to have mining itself. I mean, the conversations around the critical minerals that lie under the soil of Africa cannot even be overstated. But we've got to make sure that we mine. But not just do we mine these minerals out of the earth. It's about how do we value add so that that true value, the employment, stays in Africa. We're talking about a growing population in Africa. Yeah. The statistics say something to the extent that 60% of people in the world under 25 are in Africa. Mm-hmm. So we've got to make sure that we're able to feed those people. Yeah. So agriculture is a key sector as well. But just general industrialization, manufacturing of all goods, so that Africa doesn't have to rely on external parties or the outside world necessarily when there are shocks coming up as we have now. Right. And we're still having to depend on fertilizer from everywhere else. We could have created and we should be able to do all of that for ourselves.
And another important factor to all of this is SMEs, small businesses. It's often seen as the backbone of African economies. But are they getting the enough support that they need? And what sort of practical support can the private sector help in terms of turning this around?
So look, I mean, access to financing for SMEs has always been a critical and a topic of conversation constantly. But I think it goes beyond that. It goes beyond just access to finance. It's sustainable support in terms of the technical expertise, how we create market linkages for the SMEs. So all of that has to come into play. And I think as a public sector, certainly when I speak for me as First Rand and FNB Zambia, which is part of the First Rand group, is the work we do around SME connectivity to large corporates. the work we do in terms of supporting through products that support SME to be able to service their big corporate clients, but also about how we create pools of funding that are accessible and affordable
right.
for a small business that's starting to grow.
Yeah.
Because, yes, there's a very high cost of capital for Africa because of the perceived risk of many of our African markets. But how do we create those pools of funds that are easy for the SMEs or affordable for the SMEs, easy and affordable for the SMEs to access? But also, I think in some of our markets, we're starting to see the emergence of alternative investment markets
right.
on your stock exchanges. Again, we should make these as easy as possible. It can't be a big company doing a big IPO. We have to make sure those processes for the SMEs are that much easier. But it's also around that technical support. Some of the stuff we have done at FNB Zambia
right.
is actually partner with audit firms to provide tax services at a very discounted rate. And Blaine, I'm talking at around 75% discount from audit firms, from legal firms, and they become part of the shared prosperity
right.
philosophy that anchors First Rand in how we support the SMEs. Because shared prosperity means that as we grow as a bank, we want the communities around us to grow.
Correct.
Because
meanwhile, Uganda and DRC Congo signed deals to boost regional cooperation.
The deals were announced following talks between Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni and DRC's Tshisekedi at State House in Entebbe. Tshisekedi is in Uganda for two main events, Museveni's swearing in for a seventh term and the ninth session of the Joint Permanent Commission between the two countries. A major outcome of the talks was the DRC's proposal to join Uganda's oil infrastructure projects already under development, including pipelines and refineries. Museveni said he welcomed the proposal, describing it as a step towards deeper regional economic integration. The agreements also reinforced growing security cooperation between the two neighbors. In recent years, Uganda and the DRC have carried out joint military operations against armed groups in the eastern DR Congo, including the Allied Democratic Forces. Economic ties have also expanded, with eastern DRC remaining one of Uganda's biggest export markets. For both governments, the latest agreements are seen as a way to strengthen security and boost regional trade amid ongoing instability in the eastern DRC. Michael Balekesi, GTN, Kampala.
Experts highlight key takeaways from Africa's Africa Forward Summit.
Is unprecedented because Franco-African summits are often held in Europe, Paris to be specific, but unusually, now we have this big summit being held in Africa, Nairobi. This shows that there has been fundamental changes in the dynamics in the continent and the global dynamics, where the world has increasingly moved towards multipolarity. So many emerging powers are playing roles in Africa, and traditional powers are also present. And so in such competition, the Franco-African Summit being held in Nairobi is quite significant. The fact is that since 2020, when the chain of coups started in West Africa, France's foothold in West Africa has been limited. In fact, in many of these countries, diplomatic ties and security ties that France formerly had with these countries has been curtailed. However, it is not enough to say that France is trying to take or regain its strength in East Africa, because in recent years, it has engaged Nigeria, Liberia, Ghana, very significant. And these are Anglophone countries that are also in West Africa. But as we know, East Africa is mostly dominated by Anglophone countries. And now that France is trying to diversify its influence or diversify its presence in Africa, Kenya is thought to be an ideal place to hold such a summit. So one thing is that in 2026, when you have a colonialist mentality in your engagement, or when you are engaging Africa and you have colonialist mentality that will be achieved, because Africans have become very conscious. We have growing youth that are increasingly understanding the history of colonialism. And so nobody is willing to accept that in 2026 you engage his country with that mentality. And so France, Macron, being an anti-establishment candidate when he emerged in France, he feels that with the last year left for him to leave office, this is the time for him to redefine the French engagement with Africa, or France's relationship with Africa. And I think that he's currently approaching it with a win-win mentality, rather than it used to be, where it was more of a domineering relationship. And so if you observe the French president's demeanor and the way he's approaching things, he's now looking for a win-win game, and that is what Africans have been asking for. And many powers that are emerging, both middle powers and established powers and great powers, are all using this approach, because Africans are currently conscious, and more so, they have significant resources to back such baggage. The advantage they have is that they don't have any post-colonial arrangement with France. In fact, when Charles de Gaulle assumed the presidency in 1950s, and with that kind of strong presidency, it meant that he arranged the kind of independence that Francophone countries had, or their colonies had. And this meant that there was overwhelming influence from France, from metropolitan France. And France, for a long time, saw its colonies as extension, or its former colonies as extension of France. And that has stopped. And for Anglophone Africa, most of who were dominated by Britain, that did not happen with them. The British used indirect rule. So most Anglophones had that kind of true independence, so to speak. However, countries are going to be cautious, so that no relationship becomes that kind of asymmetrical. They want more win-win, equal footing, and respect for their sovereignty. And I think that is what is going to govern, or that mentality is go, or that kind of ideas are going to shape the kind of relationship that these Anglophone countries would have with France. And I think France gets that message very well.
Macron Ruto urged a permanent African seat on the UN Security Council. That is at the Africa Forward Summit.
There was a flurry of activity on the final day of the summit. African leaders pushed for reforms to global financial institutions, voicing concerns over the continent's ability to access affordable credit.
There is capital in Africa, but Africa's development projects remain starved of financing. The issue, therefore, is not liquidity. It is risk architecture.
President Emmanuel Macron hailed growing cooperation between France and Africa, announcing new investment commitments. France says public and private companies will invest $16 billion, while African businesses pledged another $10 billion towards energy transition, agriculture, artificial intelligence, and the maritime economy. The investments are expected to create nearly 250,000 jobs across Africa and France.
We will have the results of this Africa Forward Summit. We already see these results, these investments, our common commitments.
Leaders also renewed calls for Africa to have permanent representation on the UN Security Council, arguing the continent must have a stronger voice on global issues affecting its future. The summit brought together leaders from more than 30 countries and thousands of delegates. A final declaration is expected to outline key commitments and proposals agreed on during the summit. Robert Nagila, CGTN.
Also, analysts share insights on the UN Gerry expansion in Nairobi.
Yeah, I think the groundbreaking is very important because coming with the Trump budget cuts on the UN, The UN has really been moving a lot of its offices from New York to Nairobi to cut on costs because of some of the budget challenges they've been having from the Trump administration slashing the UN budget. And I also think it's important to bring more UN offices to Africa and to Nairobi in particular, because this is actually where most of the recipients or beneficiaries of the UN aid are actually domiciled in Africa. So by having it in Nairobi, it's closer to most of the people that benefit from UN services and the UN office in Nairobi. I think the other thing to remember is that the UN office in Nairobi is the third largest UN center after New York and Geneva, and the only UN office domiciled in the Global South. So I think just on a whole range of levels, whether it's financial in terms of managing budgetary cuts by bringing it to a cheaper space in terms of Nairobi as opposed to New York, I think in terms of, you know, a Global South perspective, the move is also very important in relation to that. Kenya serves as a climate change hub. As we know, the United Nations Environmental Programme is centered in Gigiri and also UN Habitat. So Kenya is a climate change hub for over 160 countries. And in addition to that, it's significant, like I mentioned earlier, in terms of the Global South perspective, because the UN has really been striving not only to cut costs by having its offices centered in Africa and in Nairobi in particular, and not New York, but it's important then to have it closer to where the challenges actually are. Right, because Africa contributes the least to climate change, but suffers the most challenges, right, the consequences of climate change. So it's really important in that light, but it's also important in terms of the 160 countries that would be served by the United Nations office in Nairobi. And also it's important in terms of having the UN office there in relation to thinking about some of the solutions that will be provided by some of that investment. It's an investment of over $340 million. So you can imagine the multiplier effect of that kind of money on the ground in relation not only to expansion of conference facilities, the UN HCR is also expanding its offices in addition to the UN office in Nairobi. So it really has a, you know, a massive effect on a whole range of different levels.
And some international news. Thousands of children are said to have been killed in occupied West Bank.
UNICEF says some 70 children have been killed in the region since January 2025, at least one on average every week.
January 2025 and today, at least one Palestinian child has been killed on average every single week in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. So that's 70 Palestinian children killed in this time frame. Now, 93% of those were killed by Israeli forces, and a further 850 Palestinian children were injured. Most of those killed or wounded were done by live ammunition. March 2026 saw the highest number of Palestinians injured by settler attacks in the last 20 years. And we're seeing attacks become increasingly coordinated. So documented incidents include children shot, stabbed, children beaten, and children pepper sprayed.
They visited the region, said 347 Palestinian children from the West Bank were being held in Israeli military detention for alleged security-related offences, the highest number in 8 years. He also described meeting an 8-year-old who had been beaten with a piece of wood in a settler attack and hospitalised for head injuries.
Little 8-year-old Ezeldin was beaten with a piece of wood and hospitalised for head injuries. His mother had both her arms broken when she reached across to protect her 4-month-old baby, putting therefore her arms between her baby and the attacker's club. I walked with school children through the West Bank so as to try and help them avoid any attacks. And it's interesting to watch them walk. They don't walk in a straight line because they're constantly looking over their shoulder. This is a walk through to school. It's become a walk through fear.
While the World Health Organization says 10,000 children in the devastated strip live with life-changing injuries.
At the same time, of the 2,277 people that have had a limb amputated, less than 25% have been fitted with permanent prosthetics. This due to severe shortage of prosthetics in Gaza. Of rehabilitation-related supplies are pending clearance to enter Gaza, with waiting times ranging from 130 days to more than a year. Pending items include things such as wheelchairs, prosthetic limbs, and basic rehabilitation equipment such as stationary bicycles. And every day that rehabilitation services in Gaza remain under-resourced is a day that preventable disability risks become permanent.
More broadly, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says 18,000 patients in Gaza remain without urgently needed treatment.
Crisis in the enclave continues to be characterized by widespread destruction, mass displacement, and the near collapse of essential services. And while the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is technically still in place, it's increasingly fragile and under heavy strain amid continued Israeli military strikes targeting Hamas operatives and infrastructure. The militant group that continues to assert control and influence in the Strip has rejected ceasefire demands to fully disarm. Shervin Weisby's SABC News, New York.
The EU met to meet Taliban officials in Brussels.
The European Commission, a letter has been sent to the de facto authorities in Afghanistan to inquire about the possibility of a technical meeting here in the Belgian capital. Commission spokesperson adds that the focus will be on the return of Afghan migrants deemed to pose a security threat. No firm date has been set for the talks that are being coordinated with the Swedish government. A media report suggests they could take place as early as next month. Hundreds of thousands of Afghans have sought asylum in Europe since the Taliban takeover in 2021. But the EU has been tightening its migration policies. The European Council on Refugees and Exiles says the possible deportation plan could expose Afghans currently residing in Europe to danger and abuse. Since taking power, the Taliban has enforced morality laws and rolled back citizens' rights, particularly for women and girls. Rights groups have also expressed concerns over Afghanistan's current humanitarian crisis. According to the United Nations, more than 17 million people in the country are food insecure. William Dunslow, SABC News, Brussels.
And with that, we have come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dengi program brought to you by Peniambiko. Join us from Indafa. Happy Juju. It is goodbye. And have yourself a wonderful public holiday. Please do rest and make sure you get all the necessary rest that's needed.